This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you guys doing? And welcome to another episode of the MH podcast. Very irregular podcast, but an exciting one nonetheless. And we've got a very exciting guest, Sneeko, a very notorious, prolific YouTuber who unfortunately has been deplatformed, an individual who's actually been mentioned, to my knowledge, in the Senate in the United States of America because of this this issue of censorship. I think it's a good place for us to start, Sneeko. What exactly happened? Did you break any community guidelines such that YouTube could decide to take you off the platform?
Yeah, I would like to call myself a former YouTuber, now Rumbler. And I guess I did break community guidelines, but there's very specific guidelines and there's a specific narrative that they try to push with their what you're allowed to talk about and what you're not allowed to talk about. I don't want to get you a strike if I talk about these certain issues, but it relates to Big Pharma and Pfizer and the election misinformation, cyberbullying, just, you know, random political issues that they want you to have a specific idea about. And if you don't believe in what they want you to believe.
Sorry to cut you off. Were you given a strike and then a second strike and a third strike, or was it just one go?
It was three strikes, but the last two came in the same week. And the last actual strike was circumvention. So I had a strike for cyberbullying for a video that was a couple months old after the COVID misinformation, after election misinformation. And then they gave me a circumvention strike because I posted on my second channel saying, hey guys, I got a strike. I can't stream for a week. I'll see you soon. And they said that I was circumventing the ban by still posting. And not only did they delete my two channels, but also any fan channel, anybody who had Sneeko in the title that were uploading clips. And I allowed people to, I encourage people to go and clip it up and put it on TikTok, YouTube Shorts, IG Reels. They wiped it completely. And I even made new channels afterwards banned. They are actively trying to wipe it out. And that was played in the Senate committee for inspiring domestic terrorism, for platforming somebody that they call a Holocaust denier and singing a Jewish song.
And my question to you is, first of all, did these strikes happen within a very short period of time, or did it happen over a long period of time?
In a short period of time. It was about a little less than a month. And I even had some false strikes that they tried to get me for. At one point, I was wearing what I'm wearing now, wearing a tank top, and I was doing push-ups. And they gave me a nudity strike, but I was able to appeal that. But I mean, there was a lot of instances of people were watching my stream on BotTube before I was banned. They saw that they were actively censoring it all the time. If I would talk about 9/11, suddenly the stream would just shut off in the middle. They saw me get played in the Senate. They saw them many, many times, like certain subjects, the stream would just freeze and the YouTube would say policy violation, stream off.
When did this thing start happening? Was there a turning point? Because from my understanding, your content or your character and your persona changed throughout your kind of public life. Maybe some of the things that you were saying in the beginning was more in line with some of the liberal values, and then you became a little bit more, I don't know, people say that you've become red pill. Is that a fair assessment, or is that not a fair assessment?
I would say yes and no. There were certain ideas that I would follow that were liberal, but at the same time, I was undercover red pill for a long time. I voted for Trump in high school when I was 18. That was the first presidential election that I participated in. And I kept that secret for a while when I was in college because I didn't want to get called a racist Trump supporter. And as well, even back in 2015, I was talking about feminism and why that's a lie. And I was talking about how I was inspired by Malcolm X specifically. Obviously, shout out to he had a transition from the Nation of Islam to actually going to Mecca and having his Hajj. Is that the correct terminology? You say you have your Hajj? Is that the right word to say it?
Yeah, Hajj. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
You have your Hajj?
Yeah, you can say you've done a Hajj, or you've gone to pilgrimage, or you've gone to Hajj, or it's fine.
Yeah, I was talking about that and how Malcolm X really inspired me. And I was talking about feminism as brainwashing. And I was talking a lot of red pill ideologies, but I would say the 1 minute podcast series, this was a street interview series I did in New York City. I still do it, but it's a little bit difficult now because of the cancellation. But I did this 1 minute podcast series where I'd set up a microphone and a table and in the middle of the subway stations in New York City. And so I would just interview people. And I was asking questions that I really wanted to figure out what the public thought about, because there was these ideas being pushed in 2017, 2018, like fat acceptance. And I just asked people, is it okay to be fat? And seeing people try to justify why it's okay to be fat and not knowing why, or asking people, are men and women equal? Everybody really wanted to say, yes, men and women are equal, but they had no reasoning why. So figuring out that everybody was programmed to operate over with feelings over facts, I think that really made me realize how much brainwashing there is, and I would say fully red-pilled me.
And how has your life changed, like in terms of, maybe not to be too personal about this, in terms of your, for example, finances or something like that, before and after YouTube? So for example, now that you're on Rumble, I take it, and I don't know what other, I think you're on Twitter as well, of course.
Got my Twitter back.
Just recently been reinstated, yeah? So you're on a couple of streams, but obviously YouTube has monetary advantages. So you can have advertisements, you can have sponsors and all that. Have you taken a hit financially from this?
Well, when they canceled me off of YouTube, they froze about $200,000 from ad revenue. I was doing really well on Google AdSense. And one thing for anybody listening, if they terminate you, they keep all the money that they owe you. They froze my AdSense account as well. But financially, I just have to be more diligent now. And the truth is, Tristan Tate was telling me this, that you can't rely on AdSense when you're talking about this. It's like, there's no point in ever relying on advertisers. You need to start your own businesses. So I have my course, The Creativity Kit, that's doing really well. It's actually releasing tomorrow at midnight. I'm not sure when this is going to go up, but this is my private network where I teach people how to make money online. And I have a lesson every day from different wealth creation methods. And also it's a network of people who want to go and find like-minded people who want to make money online and start a business. So and also
is
Rumble.
Is it quite similar to Hustlers University? Or
It's more curated to a specific group. I'm only limiting it to 1,000 people because I do a lot of the lessons. I was in there last month, 3 times a week, talking to people and answering questions and teaching people, bringing on different professors from drop shipping and e-commerce, web design, crypto, trying to teach people and bring everything that I've learned. I've learned a lot in the past few months from a lot of different millionaires. And so I'm trying to bring that to my audience. So it's more curated and specific. And also it's a networking community. There's people in there that have met and actually moved together and started businesses together from that community, because I've always attained the idea that it's hard to find like-minded people with the circle that are around you. A lot of people that I grew up with, you know, they're playing Fortnite, playing GTA, smoking weed, playing FIFA, doing the same things that we were doing back when we were 16, 17. And sure, that's fun. There's nothing wrong with that. But I'm on a constant journey of growth, and I can't grow if people are constantly playing FIFA. So the people that I work with, I've all met them online, and I want to provide that for the people that watch my streams.
I see. And so you're talking about your own personal journey. Have you looked into Islam as a way of life that you could potentially embrace yourself at all?
Of course I have. I've been thinking about Islam for a long time. I think the first time that I was really seriously considering it, people will think that I'm lying about this, but I was really infatuated with Malcolm X when I was very young, his autobiography, seeing his journey and how he went from living a degenerate life, you know, stealing, robbing, pimping, dealing drugs, and then finding Islam as well. First, the Nation of Islam, but then finding, you know, the true religion, which he called it, of Islam. And also seeing how he transitioned from being a militant person who was really pro segregation. The reason that he wasn't assassinated early was because he agreed with a lot of the white supremacists that Martin Luther King was fighting against. So Malcolm X was pro-segregation, just on the opposite side. And he was realistic. And he was also warning people about white liberals. I think that's relevant to this day, that he said that you can't trust white liberals because they pretend to be on your side, but they're really even more of a snake than the people that are in charge of everything. So I think that he was a realist. But seeing at the end how he was able to grow, and when he went to Mecca and he came back, he started advocating for peace, and he started advocating for unity, and he started advocating for love. And I think that was the transition from the Nation of Islam to Islam. And I think that's why they assassinated him, because the one thing that can get you in trouble with the powers that be is trying to spread the ideas of love. But to answer your question earlier, I just want to clarify that anybody interested about Rumble, the Rumble AdSense is better than YouTube per view. YouTube yep. takes a bigger of a cut from super chats, from everything. Rumble is a very viable option. Obviously, there's less there's less active audience members, but Rumble, the ad revenue is better than YouTube.
Interesting. Going back to the point that we were talking about, I mean, have you looked at, have you read any parts of the Quran yourself, or like any of, have you seen any particular videos or any, what do you know of Islam as it stands? What would you, how would you summarize what you understand of Islam?
My manager, his name is Islam. My former editor is praised five times a day. I've seen a lot of your videos. I've seen a lot of your debates in Hyde Park in London. I have a very strong Islamic audience. Even before I started streaming and people say that I fully embraced the red pill, I used to do meetups before I, like, you know, the streaming stuff. When I was just making YouTube videos, I used to do meetups in Hyde Park and around Europe. And I noticed that there were so many Muslims coming to the meetups, and it really surprised me because I was saying I didn't believe in God and I was atheistic. But for some reason, what I was talking about resonated with a lot of Muslim people. And I, a lot of people that I associate with and that I, that I've read and understood, they have found peace in Islam. And it also, it seems like a sanctuary from all the degeneracy in the West. I moved out of New York City because I kept seeing the, what was going on, the pride parades and how drag queens are in schools now and what children are being exposed to. And it's really, I think it's disgusting. And they call you a homophobe, they call you transphobe if you talk about that. But I think that putting a pride parade in the middle of a classroom with a bunch of five-year-old children is actively promoting sexual deviance to children. And I think that that's the decline of the West. The new religion of the West is woke. The new religion of the West is the blue-haired feminist, is climate change activism. That is their God. And that's what made me start believing in God again. I grew up as a Catholic, but I left because I started doubting that the different scriptures were just different versions of the same thing. But seeing how degenerate society in the West was becoming because of the lack of God made me realize that there must be something positive out there. There must be some God out there. But I haven't read the Quran. I want to. I'm reading the Bible right now. When I finish the Bible, I want to read the Quran.
Yeah. You mentioned you started to believe in God again. What is your conception of God? Like, so for example, obviously different religions have different ideas of what God is. In Christianity, there's a specific idea. In Judaism, there's a specific idea. In Islam, there's a specific idea. When you say God, what do you mean exactly?
It's hard to really describe because I pray to the Christian God, I guess. I do the sign of the cross, and sometimes I'll say the Our Father or Hail Mary. But to be perfectly honest with you, it seems like it's hard to really figure out what exactly it is. It, in my head, it's a positive force that looks out for the entire world. It's everything that's good about the world. I want to believe that it's a person. God made us in our image, but I see the way that Buddhists are happy, and I see the way that different religious people find happiness, and it just seems like God is a positive force, and so the belief in that is the best way to live. I have a hard time looking at any specific book and thinking that this is the word of God when they seem like different versions of the same ideas.
Okay, well, let's start with that. I think it's a good place to start because in terms of conceptions of God, let's start with the two major world religions by way of demography in the world today, which is Christianity and Islam, right? Because this is what I would put to you. I'd submit to you that the main difference between Christianity and Islam is that whereas Christianity or Christian people must believe in the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, these are three persons of God, that God is comprised of three persons, that the Father is God, the Son is God, and that the Holy Spirit is God, and that, but there are not three gods, but one God. This is the formulation of what the Trinity really is. So Jesus Christ, for the Christian, is God, the Father is God, the Holy Spirit is God, but there is only one God. Now, the Islamic response to that is that that's an unintelligible proposition. Mm-hmm. That in fact, you can't say that the Jesus is God, that the Father is God, that the Holy Spirit is God, but there's not three gods, but one God. Really, what you're counting is three different gods here. And we would say there's even bigger problems when you start thinking about the fact that Jesus is a man, as a human being. And this idea that a man can be God is something which the Muslim person would completely reject. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is, Muslim people would describe God as the all-powerful, the all-knowing, the one that does not need sleep, does not need rest. That's unlike, obviously, you know, resting on the seventh day in Genesis and stuff like that. We would say, in fact, God doesn't need to rest. God doesn't need to sleep. God doesn't get tired. God is all-knowing. God is all-powerful. God is all-merciful. God is loving, as you've mentioned. And this is our conception of God. Of the two, which do you think is a more you know, plausible conception of God? Would you say the Islamic conception, or would you say the Christian conception?
I see what you're saying, and that's some of the criticism I've had when I've been reading the Bible, the fact that God needed a day to rest. If he's all-knowing and all-powerful, why would he need to rest? Why is he not perfect? And I see what you're saying, and I've had similar debates before with Muslim scholars. The name is lost on me right now. But yeah, I do think you provide a valid argument.
Yeah, I mean, so it's really and truly, this is the main difference between Christianity and Islam. So the point about when you're saying, when you're reading different scriptures and you saw kind of different, you know, different wordings of the same thing, or can't exactly remember what words you use, but this is one of the differences, I guess. I'm not saying that in the Bible, in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, the idea of the Trinity is there, because I would actually say that the Trinity is not even mentioned in the Bible. The idea that you have co-equal and co-eternal, three co-equal, co-eternal persons of God, this is not something that, for example, is anywhere in the Old Testament. You will not find that in the Old Testament anywhere. And it's not something in the New Testament even. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. You know, before there used to be verses that were seen as interpolations that were then taken out because people realized that were fabrications. For example, in the first epistle of John, chapter 5, verse 7, where it says that there are three that bear the record in heaven, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And then later on, people realized that this was a 15th century fraud fabrication. And so they said it's not part of the Bible, which is why now if you go to the New International Version of the Bible, the Revised Standard Version, or even I think the King James Version, some of them at least, you won't find this verse in there. And so the truth is the Trinity is not mentioned in the Bible. Where you'll find that the Trinity is mentioned
is in Roman Catholicism, correct?
Pardon?
Is in mostly Roman Catholics promote the Holy Trinity.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was that, you're right, it's the Catholic Church, if you like. You know, it's what happened was in the first kind of 200-300 years of Christianity, there was an evolution of thought. And so there was a development in the doctrine. You have different councils. You can easily look them up, which are like, for example, the Council of Nicaea, the Council of Constantinople, Chalcedon, 325, 381, and 451, respectively. All of these are the years when they start doing these big councils. And in those times, the formulation of what God was started to change. Like, for example, in 325, when they did the famous Council of Nicaea, the Catholic Church, they didn't have the Holy Spirit as a co-equal and co-eternal God. They did mention him as Lord, but he wasn't a co-equal, co-eternal God. By 381, he became a co-equal and co-eternal God. So it was kind of like a binitarianism, and then after it became a Trinitarianism, after, you know, the Holy Spirit was added to the mix. So what we're saying is that if you can't find it in the Old Testament, you can't find it in the Bible, you can trace a clear historical development. And also, you know, this is something which is not what the prophets have said in the, like, for example, Abraham and Moses and these great prophets in the Old Testament have not said anything about a Trinity. You come to realize that this idea was not something which was intended by God. And quite frankly, it's not something which is very rational either. Like, once again, this idea that God is a man, it's just beggars belief that people can, because when we say God, I mean, what is God? God is all powerful. A man is not all powerful. A man is limited. God is unlimited. So you can't have both in the same, in the same entity. Do you see where I'm coming from here?
I agree. I've had this debate with Christians and Muslims before, and I think that that's a very valid argument for Islam. I'm wondering though, and I'm not trying to be offensive in any sense, but I've had debates with a lot of blue-haired feminists and these types of people. And when I talk about my interest in Islam, they bring up the fact that the Prophet Muhammad, he was married to a girl that was underage. What is the response to that? Because I don't know how to respond to that in a debate.
Yeah, man. So, I mean, we've done, I'm part of something called the Sapiens Institute, which is the institute which I co-founded. We've done a three-part series on this question, because it's one of the most common questions in the West. Like, why is it that the Prophet Muhammad, you know, married Aisha at the age of 9, or there was a, you know, intimacy at the age of 9, and so on. And so the first thing I would say is that if you want a more detailed answer of what, you know, I'm about to mention now, you can obviously go and see these. I've done three-part series. The second thing I would say is that, look, I mean, first and foremost, you could technically believe in Islam and not believe that the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam or the Prophet Muhammad married Aisha at the age of 9. In other words, it's not something, it's not an article of faith. One must believe that the Prophet Muhammad married, you know, Aisha at the age of 9, that there was some kind of consummation. I'm not saying this is not, this is a red herring that many people try and bring about in order to create some kind of a distraction to the key tenets of Islam. But let's take the historical account, because quite frankly, there are some revisionist accounts, which some people have brought forward today and said, no, she wasn't 9, she was 18, or she was 21, or whatever. Looking at it myself, I don't agree with those accounts. I think that those accounts are not correct. I think it's correct that he married her at the age of 9. That's what happened, and that's something that she mentions herself, in fact, and it's narrated in Sahih al-Bukhari authentically. So the question is, why and how? The real answer is, bro, you're kind of alluding to it before, which is that we have social constructs. Social constructs, not the kind that the feminists and the ones on the far left are talking about, which is that they say sex is a social construct, or that, like, for example, Judith Butler said sex itself, biological sex, the penis, in a sense, is a social construct. We're not talking about that. We do have some social constructs. And ironically, I think the social constructs are those things which cannot be empirically justified. And I think one of those things is the idea of childhood. I'll be totally honest with you and tell you, how do we determine what is a child? I mean, historically, we've always understood the idea of childhood as corresponding with either biological ability or psychological capability, or a combination of both. The ability of somebody to work or to be domestic, or have effective domesticality, and all these kinds of things. When I looked at the issue from a historical perspective, I started to realize why the West in particular has started to redefine what it means to be a child. And I think I've got the answer. Because, you know, in the 1800s, you'll find that, quite frankly, people were getting married in the United Kingdom at the age of 10 or 12. And in America, all the way down in Delaware, it was actually 9 years old or 7 years old. It was legal to get married at this age. So when did it shift? It actually shifted here in the United Kingdom when 1914, obviously, as you know, 1914 to 1918, there was World War I. And after World War I, there was an infrastructural mess in parts of Western Europe. And the ideas of education started to change. So legislatively, there was a law that was put forward in 1924 or 1925, I cannot remember exactly the year, but it was a law that changed the marriage age from 12 years old to about 16 years old. So in England, where I'm speaking from, the age to get married was 12, and then it changed to 16. Now, you might ask, what is the reason? Actually, funny enough, ironically, once again, part of it was to do with some protesting from the first wave feminists. I looked at some Hansard records, which are basically the records of Parliament and so on. So I was wanting to see what exactly the reason was. Another part of the reason, in my opinion, was the fact that education started to be seen as, or when somebody would finish education, would start to be seen as the appropriate time of when adulthood begins. So in the United Kingdom, for example, I think in America it's very similar, the age until compulsory education is 16 years old. So it's almost as if they're telling us, look, you're not a real man, you're not a real woman, you're not an adult yet until you finish the educational program that we have in place for you. You have to be 16 and then you're an adult then. Now, this is completely alien in the historical landscape. I mean, this has never been how any civilization, almost at any point in time, in 6,000, 5 to 6,000 years of human civilizational existence, has ever understood what it means to be an adult. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, we should change it and go back to our old days, because it's very difficult now to get a young person of today to do the actions that they were doing yesterday. But what I am saying is that it makes no sense to take these social constructs, which are not based on biological fact. They are merely social constructs, literally things which have been put in place or have been understood to be okay, aesthetically pleasing, relativistic understandings by liberal people after the First World War and Second World War, to be more particular. It became even more pronounced because there was an even bigger mess then infrastructurally, and then they needed education even more to fix up economies. And so this idea of childhood corroborating or corresponding or being commensurate with educational age, or the end of childhood being when the education ends, became even more prominent. So what I'm saying is that, yes, it did happen, according to the most authentic historical account. And no, we don't think there's any problem with it at all. We think that it's just because we have a different idea of what it means to be a child, which can be tracked historically. But now, if the situation has changed, we'd say that the general principle in Islam is, you know, you can do what you kind of want, so long as, I'm not going to say you can do what you want so long as you're harming. You can marry whomever you want to marry, so long as it doesn't cause them harm, physical and psychological. So, for example, if I marry a 100-year-old woman, or a sneaker, if you marry with your tank top a 100-year-old woman, and you know, and you get involved with her intimately, she might die. I mean, she might have some kind of health problem. So we would say that, well, if you were to be intimate with a 14-year-old or, you know, 13-year-old who's got huge hips and huge breasts and huge body, I mean, quite frankly, we would say it's not going to have the same effect medically. I mean, no one can make the argument. But in these countries where we live in now, one is legal and one is illegal. So for in other words, you can't marry a 100-year-old woman, but you can marry that girl that's, you know, with the... You can't be, you're a pedophile if you go for the girl that's got the hips. And once again, pedophilia is very relative, because if you go to Russia, the age of consent is 14. But in England, it's 16. And parts of America, it's 18. And other parts of America, it's 18. And other parts of the world, is 21. So one man's pedophile is another man's good citizen, a liberal actor. So the point of who sets the age is another issue, because it's very arbitrary at this point. But we're not saying, therefore, we should go back to a time where the age is not set. We're not saying any of that stuff. We're just saying that to use this as an argument against the veracity of the truthfulness of the religion of Islam is unsatisfactory, I would say. What do you think about that? And feel free to push back.
I think that's a good explanation. I think 9 is very young.
It's very young to us. Music.
How old was Muhammad at the time? We don't need to stay on this subject, but there's other we could talk. I was just wondering, because in debates, I want to figure out how to continue, because that always comes up, especially from Christians.
I agree.
When the debate comes up, I wanted to see how to navigate that.
Okay. What is young? What does it mean to be young?
To be innocent, to be childlike, and even not even going through puberty, also physically not matured yet.
Okay, beautiful, excellent. So you've mentioned some key terms, right? Innocence and puberty, because these are things which are measurable. Now we can start to talk about it. Frankly, we believe that Aisha, at the time, she had gone through puberty. So we actually have evidence of Aisha saying that she had gone through puberty at that time. So that's one aspect. The reason why he didn't marry her before, because she hadn't gone through puberty yet. Now, if you look at the numbers of people that go through puberty at whatever age, you will find a percentage of people even today that go through puberty at the age of 9. So yes, 9 is very young. This is what some of the revisionists of today say. They say she was 18 and they make their own theories. And once again, we're not saying that they're therefore they're not Muslim or they're liberals or whatever. I'm just saying that at the end of the day, it's not a point which, if you don't believe in it, you become a disbeliever. Because quite frankly, the Prophet himself didn't say it. It's what you call a mawquf hadith, or it's a hadith that goes back to a companion, not a hadith that goes back to the Prophet. However, what I will say, having said that, is that since she had gone through puberty, yeah, nine is very young, but in ancient times, people were doing very many things that we consider to be, you know, something which an adult would do at very young ages. If you look at ancient Sparta and ancient Athens, people were soldiers, boys were soldiers at the age of 5 and 6. Now, we would consider that to be abhorrent. I'm not even saying that should be the case. I'm saying that people did things at ages in different times in human history that they wouldn't do now. In the age of distraction, playing PlayStation and playing a FIFA while smoking marijuana, people don't realize that we're living in the age of distraction. We're living in the lazy age. We have the luxuries to do those things that we're doing now, which is to sit down and play FIFA and these things, whatever the kids do nowadays. And I've played FIFA myself. I'm not as probably good as the gamers out there, but I'm just saying that we're living in the age of distraction. If there was no such distraction and there was war, there was continuous war. It's not what the historians refer to as Pax Americana, because America is the superpower of today. So, you know, that the wars are not happening as much as they used to because there is no more vying for dominance, and therefore we're not lazy because we're not going to war. We're doing what men have done historically for the last 6,000 years. The conversation would be completely different, you see. So what I'm saying to you is that clearly there's a historical significance here, but there are principles at play also. So we're not saying that therefore we should bring we should get married to 9-year-olds and 10-year-olds, 11. We're just saying that there are principles which are that so long as the society has structures which support certain practices, and there are no consequences which are negative, then we wouldn't consider it to be immoral. Because, frankly, something is only immoral which if you can improve it. You have to prove that something is immoral. So if I said, well, a 9-year-old who had gone through puberty and who her whole family and the society accepted it was normal for her to do such a thing, why is it immoral for her to engage in sexual activity? I don't see in a historical age for a 9-year-old 1,400 years ago that has the full support of her family and the community and that had gone through puberty for her to engage in sexual activity. And for someone to say, yes, it's immoral for that person to engage in sexual activity, they would have to now produce some kind of evidences for that. You see the point?
I see the point. But don't you see the hypocrisy in my belief system? Part of the reason that I'm trying to find religion and I'm trying to find the word of God is because of, I think the next objective of the woke movement is to normalize pedophilia. They're calling pedophiles minor attracted people. They are putting the pride flags in school. There's videos on Libs of TikTok, shout out to that Twitter page, of like children tipping drag queens at 5-6 years old. And woke people will come in here and defend that and say that twerking isn't a sexual act. Or they'll say that this is just performance. This is one of the core philosophies.
Yeah. Sorry to cut you off. Have you watched that that famous documentary, What is a Woman?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Now, that guy, when he went out, I forget his name now.
Matt Walsh.
What's his name again? Walsh. Yeah, Matt Walsh,
yeah.
When he went out and he started asking everyone, what is a woman? Yeah. And those woke guys on the left were saying a woman is, and they didn't want to answer the question. They had no answer. And then they went to different places and the people in Africa and in Asia, and anyone knows how to answer it.
Yeah.
If I were to ask you, what is a woman, Sneaker?
Yeah.
I know you're going to give me the answer I need, but if I were to ask you, what is a woman, what would you say?
A human with a vagina.
Okay, human with a vagina, fine. Or X chromosomes. Or all of these are acceptable answers, right? Or
a woman born with a vagina.
Yeah, fine. But what would differentiate it from a girl, for example? From a young girl, like a baby girl.
Maturity, physical maturity.
Physical maturity. Now, you've just answered your question about the age of Aisha. Because what I've just asked you, what is a woman? And so all of the things that you've just said about what a woman is applicable to the Prophet's marriage to Aisha. Because we're saying, is she a woman or is she not a woman? Your definition is the definition of what she was, according to what she said. She believes that she was mature. She was narrating hadith and she was a historical scholar at a very young age, comparatively. And she was physically mature. and there was no evidence of her being harmed in the process and so on. That's one thing. Now, if I were to say, look, what is a child, Sneeko? What is a child?
A human without physical maturity and still innocent learning, and that needs the responsibility of their parents.
Fantastic. So what's problematic here is, let's say, for example, if we say that a child is whatever I decide it is to be, whatever the policymakers decide, if it's 16, 14, 12. If we decide that a child is someone under the age of 18, for example, even though they are physically mature, is that wokeism? What is that? How would you define such a thing? Is that is that a biological determiner, or is that something else?
I guess that's a social construct.
It's a social construct. So what I'm saying is that, you know, what we're talking about, the laws of pedophilia in this country and everywhere else are based on arbitrary lines set by policymakers. What we're saying is they're not based on hard scientific evidence, the like of which we would use, me and you, to define what a woman is. So
I think that's a good argument. Personally, I went through puberty when I was like 14, 15. I don't know about you, but at 9, I was not mature.
Here, same here.
Yeah.
Yeah, same here. Same here. I know. I'm quite a big lad, but I was a late bloomer in that sense myself, you know. So what I'm saying is that, yes, I appreciate what you're saying, but for us to win the argument about what these left-wing people are doing in terms of the pedophilia thing, we have to have a strong understanding of what a child is. Like, we have to go with, okay, what is a child? We have to be able to answer that question ourselves. And it has to be based on some measurable thing. Because if it's based on some social construct, so for example, if someone says, well, a 14-year-old is putting on makeup and exposed to whatever, and therefore the people on the left are exposing 14-year-old children to such and such, I'll be honest with you, such a thing, I wouldn't agree with the argument, because I would say, why are we describing this person as a child? Just because there's a certain age, a legalistic age? It's not really a strong argument. So what we have to have is kind of parameters. When do we decide this person is a child? When do we decide this person is an adult? And these things. But it's like I said, it's like the religion of Islam, it's not a barrier to entry, this issue. Because as I started off with, the religion of Islam is all about believing in one God worthy of worship, you see. So we worship the God of Abraham. We worship the God of Moses, which is and the God of Jesus. We believe that Jesus was a man, that he was the Messiah, that he was not God or the Son of God. We don't believe that he was the Son of God. Now, when we say, well, in the Bible, it says that God was created in our, we are the children of God. If you look, for example, in the book of Matthew, it says that blessed be the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. So in other words, we are saying that people got confused as to how this expression was used. The sons of God were the peacemakers, were the good people, were the, you know, the people that God created and who loves and so on. It doesn't mean that God has any begotten children, because God is above having children and families and needing acquaintances and all of these things. So we're saying that these expressions have been lost in translation in the Judeo-Christian tradition. So if one believes in that, number one, would you say you believe in that God? Is that something, if you pray to God tonight, if something happens to you right now, if you know, if Rumble, I don't know what's the guy's name, if he decides to switch it off as well, like, you know, because it could happen. I mean, we're saying Rumble, we're Rumblers or YouTubers, but the Rumble guy, could he decide to switch it off? You know, you don't know. You know, nothing is assured. And then you feel like life is getting more and more difficult. So like, what's happening now? You want to pray to God. What God are you going to be thinking about whilst you're praying? Are you going to be thinking about a man on a cross? Or are you going to be thinking about the creator of the universe, the one who moves in and maintains and sustains you, the one who's allowing you to breathe and to exist and to be sustained? Which one is it? Which would you be thinking about?
It's hard to say specifically, because part of the reason I had trouble and why I left the church is because I didn't like the idea that God was this guy. And I'm sure that there's different imagery of God, but they always, sometimes it's portrayed as like this guy in the clouds with the beard, and this white guy, and he's looking down. It's like, I don't want to, I had a hard time thinking that that was the creator of the universe. But recently, like, I wouldn't even pray for that reason. I wouldn't pray to, his name is Chris Pavlovsky. I wouldn't say that, please don't delete my, like, I got, I don't recently, I don't try to ask God for anything. I show gratitude. I ask that, I thank it for allowing me to do the right thing. And I try to speak to him without asking. Because I don't want to, I try to show gratitude more because it makes me appreciate. I think that asking too much, it just is needy. And I think about how many people are praying, asking for like to get a bunch of money in their bank account. I feel better when I just show gratitude.
I get what you're saying. Here's what I would say. Just two or three things. The first thing about imagery, like I totally agree with you. Like, you know, this idea of these images that we've seen in popular culture, this old man with a gray beard and that's it. So we don't believe in anything like that is God. That's whatever you have in your mind as an image, it cannot be God. That's the Islamic idea. In fact, there's a verse in the Quran, لَا تُدْرِكُهُ الْأَبْصَارُ وَهُوَ يُدْرِكُ الْأَبْصَارُ, which means that no one can encompass him in vision, and he encompasses everyone else in vision. In other words, whatever imagination that you have in your mind about God, it's a false imagination. It cannot be what God is. It's something which you cannot imagine God. He is the creator of the universe. He is the creator of everything that exists. If we see these kinds of, you know, sometimes these animations of the solar system and how the earth is so small comparative to the sun, and then the sun is so small comparative to the Milky Way. So imagine God created all of this. I mean, it's just inconceivable, unfathomable to the human mind. So I agree with that point. As it relates to asking God, the Islamic conception is actually a little bit different. You're on the money on one point. We would say that human beings asking other human beings for help, it is sometimes, if not always, a sign of weakness. And there is a beautiful verse in the Quran which summarizes the whole thing. Da'ufa al-talib wal-matlub. That the one who's asking other things, created things for help, is weak, has become weakened. And the thing itself that's being asked is weak. So if you ask, for example, in a relationship, you might have been in a relationship, you know, it's a very needy and weak thing to do to ask somebody in the relationship, for example, your wife or your girlfriend or whatever, oh, please don't leave me, don't go, don't do this, don't do that. Because now you're putting your dignity, your self-worth into the hands of another human being who themselves are not worthy of this thing. Mm-hmm. That person, whoever they may be, they're not worthy of that thing. Because quite frankly, they've got their own limitations, their own weaknesses, their own problems. So you might be doing that. And even with your parents, we love our parents, and our religion says you must respect your parents and give them high respect and all that. Probably most emphasis after anything that you have to obey is your parents in Islam. However, you know, we don't ask them and beg to them and these kinds of things. So the religion of Islam says that, and there's this beautiful phrase, la hawla wa la quwwata illa billah, which is that there is no changing of the circumstance or any power except with God. So there's nowhere I can go, Muhammad Hijab, and there's nowhere you can go, Sneeko, in this universe which God is not in control of. Anything that you're doing now, me raising my hand and putting it down, me speaking to you, you hearing it, all of that we believe is with the permission of God. If God did not want us to be having this conversation, we would not be having this conversation. He is in complete control of the situation. He's giving us free will to practice what we need to practice. However, he is in control of everything. He's allowing it. We're a guest in his house, if you like. That's the situation. And God does not diminish or deprecate or reduce from us asking him. And the Islamic idea is actually a little bit different, which is the Islamic idea is that if anything or anyone asks God, in fact, God, according to us, God is pleased with those who ask him more and more. The more you ask God for guidance, for help, for anything else, this is a kind of strength, actually, because you're admitting your own weakness. And you're surrendering and submitting to the one God who created you. Do you see the point here?
Yes. Instead of asking from other humans, the best exactly. Place to ask is to God.
Yeah, because like, for example, in the Catholic tradition, you have this idea of confession. You go into the box and there's a guy next to you, confession.
Which I genuinely think is one of the big flaws with Catholicism, the fact that you could commit murder, commit adultery, and then go there, and then the priest is listening in a box and then says, say 10 Hail Marys and you're absolved of your sins. I don't think that that's what God would intend. No.
Exactly that. And we say that, in fact, the Islamic idea is that if you've committed sins, you shouldn't tell anyone. That you only admit that to God. You can have conversations with God. You can ask God. You can cry. Because we're all limited and weak and vulnerable. But we need to, in order to get strong, we need to attach ourselves with the most strong thing, which is the creator of the universe. If we attach ourselves to weak things, we become weaker. If we depend, if a dependent thing depends upon other dependent things, the only thing that happens is we increase in dependence. But if a dependent thing attaches itself to an independent thing, then we increase in strength, which goes back to the idea that if you submit your will to the all-powerful creator, there's no situation in which you'll become weaker by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it's a strengthening of your resolve. To be honest, there's a second part. So really, there's two things about Islam. To become a Muslim, there's two aspects. One of it is to believe that there's only one God worthy of worship. And the other aspect is to believe that Prophet Muhammad is a true prophet. Yeah, these are the two things. If one believes in that, they're a Muslim. As we said, the conception of God in Islam, we would consider itself to be the clearest and most precise and respectable form of monotheism that there is available today. But for example, compare it with Christianity we just have, you'll see that it's a clear victory for Islam. Compare it with Judaism, where God rests on the seventh day, where God wrestles with Jacob and loses the wrestling match, where God has to repent to Israel. God is repenting himself to the tribe. We would say that this is not a sufficient understanding of what God is. Compare it with Sikhism or Hinduism or pantheism or any other ism, we would say this once again is the idea of polytheism, many, many gods or a statue that you believe in as God. We think this is all nonsense. How could something which is weak and in need itself be your God? So we would say that when you compare the conceptions of God in Islam with everything, all the other religions, that's one aspect. The other thing is the Prophet Muhammad, we believe, he came with two things. All the prophets and messengers, they came with two things fundamentally. They came with the message, which is to believe and worship in only one God. And they came with an evidence to show what kind of prophet they were. Have you come across any of the evidences of Islam?
I've seen different videos that show patterns in the universe that allude to the fact that it must have been one sole creator. If you look at, I think it's called some sequence, but yeah, the Muslims have sent me video. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, for example, this is more to do with proving God's existence. So like the fine-tuning of the universe. They say that, for example, if the universe has, this is the argument that's usually made, they say if the universe has all these kinds of numbers, which like John Rees wrote a book called Just Six Numbers, the electromagnetic force, the gravitational constant, everything is just perfectly fine-tuned so that human existence can happen, or any existence, any life can exist in the universe. That shows that there is some kind of, you know, an intelligence or a knowledge that has put into existence this universe. And I think that's a fine argument for God's existence myself, although I've developed it in later times. But I won't get into that. The point I'm getting into here with this, with the evidences of the Prophet Muhammad himself being a true prophet, revolve around a couple of things. First of all, his track record. Because number one, we know about the Prophet Muhammad's life very in a very detailed way. He was an individual who is being kind of monitored from the very beginning. In his community, he was seen as someone who was trustworthy. As Sadiq al-Amin, he was referred to as the trustworthy. People would leave things with him. They would leave, like, you know, shields, swords, all kinds of things that they would leave it in his house because they knew that he would give it back to them, that he wouldn't steal it. He was almost like a safety deposit box for people in the community to give their things. And he would resolve conflicts. I mean, this was something that was known about his character. He was never seen as an individual who is, if you like, a clout chaser. He lived a very, very humble life. I mean, he was a shepherd, and then after that became a businessman. He married a woman that was his senior in age. Only one woman. He was only with one woman for a very long time, for 15 years, in fact. And, you know, he lived a very respectable life. He used to meditate all the time. And the story goes as follows, that he went to a mountain in Mecca. He went to a mountain called Ghar Hira which is a mountain called Hira, right? Or a cave called Hira, it's in Jabal Nur. And he went into that mountain, and as he would just go there sometimes, he would spend hours and hours and hours and just contemplate. He would spend days, in fact. His wife would get him food, and he would eat the food and just think about God. It's a kind of meditation. He used to do this, a kind of meditation. Until one day, an angel came to him. And the angel told him to read in the name of your Lord. اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق. خلق الإنسان من علق. اقرأ وربك الأكرم. الذي علم بالقلم. علم الإنسان ما لم يعلم. That read in the name of your Lord. The angel said to him, read in the name of your Lord who created the human being from a clot. Read, and your Lord is the most generous. It is he who taught the human being, taught the human being by the pen. So this was the first thing that he's ever heard. And then he went to his wife. He said, you know, cover me. Zammilini, zammilini, dathirini. Cover me up. And he was very worried about what happened. And then revelation started. Now, when we say revelation started, we're talking about the angel Gabriel, or the archangel Gabriel, is an angel that is referred to in the Old Testament. He came to the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, and he continuously gave him piecemeal parts of revelation until we have what is referred to now as the Quran. So the Quran is, we would consider, to be revelation to the Prophet Muhammad from the angel Gabriel. So the first of all, this is the message. I'm not talking about the evidence just yet. The message of Islam is to believe and worship in one God, family values, be good to your fellow man. A man is a man, a woman is a woman, all these things I'm sure you know about Islam. But then you have to worship one God. There is a purpose in life. Because the question, Sneeko, if I were to ask you now, what is the purpose of life? How would you answer this question?
The purpose of life is to create more life and to serve God and to do the right thing. I think those are the three things that I try to follow.
And that's brilliant, especially the second one. We would say, look, I mean, if the purpose of life was just, I mean, because if you look at it from an evolutionary kind of biologist way, they say that species, they have two goals, survivability and reproduction. I mean, that's what animals do. They survive and reproduce. They propagate their own genetic code or whatever, yeah? And we would say that's, if that was alone, if that was the purpose of life, then there would be no difference between a human being and not even an animal, but maybe even bacteria, actually. Because a bacteria can, in fact, a bacteria would have a better purpose, or a higher, a noble, more interesting purpose, because they can survive more and they can probably reproduce at a more rapid rate. But we would say that when you consider the human species, the sentience, the idea that the human being is free-willed, that the idea that a human being can ask the question why. Nothing else in creation can ask the question why. A dog doesn't crawl around, you know, and or say, why is it? What am I doing here, you know? Or a lion doesn't do it. So what am I doing here? The metaphysical questions, or what Karl Popper referred to as the ultimate questions, doesn't happen like that. So what I'm saying is, we are the only that can do this, the only species that can do this. So we have a special purpose. And that special purpose is to submit our will to the creator of the universe. Now, we believe that messengers and prophets have been sent aforetime. Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, all of them have been sent aforetime to tell people of this purpose. But as I've said, they had two things, a message and a miracle, or some kind of evidence. So the Islamic evidences are, number one, the Quran itself. So we would say there is no contradiction in the Quran. That's the first thing. The Quran itself says there's no contradictions in there. Number one. Number two, the Quran is preserved, unlike the Bible. Muslims are fighting each other on many issues today, but they're not fighting each other on the issue of the Quran, what constitutes the Quran. You'll not find Muslims fighting each other on this issue at all. There's complete unity on this matter between Muslim people. So the Quran is preserved. Number three, the language of the Quran and the structure of the Quran We would consider it to be remarkable, and it de-scoped anything that anyone could have done. And there's some ways I can, you know, I can, resources I can push you towards that, or I can tell you how that is the case. Moreover, there are things in the Quran which predict the future. Okay, there are prophecies of the future. Now, let's say, for example, you watch sports, Nico?
No. I watch the World Cup. I'll watch like a fight once in a while, but no, I think sports are equivalent to playing video games.
Oh, interesting, interesting. I would have thought you watched sports and stuff like that.
I used to watch soccer, football, but I don't have any time anymore.
Fair enough. I mean, are you interested in any particular activities where there's winners and losers?
Fighting.
All right, fantastic. So do you watch like what, UFC? What do you watch?
UFC and boxing.
All right, so brilliant. So who are some of your favorite fighters on the UFC, for example?
I like Khabib.
Some of the people that you're watching. Let's forget favorite fighters because maybe you don't want to endorse them. But
I like Islam, and okay. I like Khabib. It's funny because yeah. I think the best fighters tend to be Islamic recently. They have a certain – they're able to fully focus. I think that's why Khabib beat Conor McGregor is because he had no other – Conor's like doing cocaine. He's drinking. He's on social media all the time. Khabib is just pray, fight. And then you see the results. That it's insane when you just submit to God, the amount of power that you have. And even Islam winning that recent fight, I forgot, he had a third round submission. And Salim, my friend from the Melk Boys, he predicted that fight. It's pretty powerful to see like how that belief can make you that much stronger.
Absolutely. So let's say Islam Makhachev versus Volk. Yeah, it's going to come. I don't know. Is it in 2 weeks' time? I don't know exactly the date. There's something in February, right?
Yeah.
Very much anticipated fight. I mean, to be fair, Alexander Volkanovsky. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right, but he's a very respectable candidate, and I think it's going to be a harder fight than people think it's going to be for Islam Makhachev. However, let's just for the sake of argument, if I said, you know, I think that Islam Makhachev is going to win, and it's going to be a first round knockout for the sake of argument. And if I claim that this information that I'm giving to you is not from myself, but it's from God. It's not from myself. It's not just an estimate that I'm guessing, but I'm just saying it's not from myself. It's from God. Now, if Islam Makhachev loses by knockout, you'll say this guy's he's a fraud. It couldn't be from God because God is all-knowing. And what you've just done here is falsified your claim to prophethood, if you like. The Quran makes prophecies about winners and losers in fights, if you like. And it does so, for example, in the context of great empires. So in the 30th chapter of the Quran predicts the Roman Empire. There were two great empires at the time, the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire. They had been in fighting with one another. The Quran predicted, and the Romans had just lost, by the way, that the Romans had just been defeated in a nearby close land, and that after that defeat, they will become victorious. And that will be fi bid'i sinin, in 3 to 9 years. So it's even given you some time or when that's going to happen. This is chapter 30 of the Quran, verses 1 to 4. لِلَّهِ الْأَمْرُ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَمِنْ بَعْدُ وَيَوْمَ إِذٍ يَفْرَحَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ To Allah belongs this matter, which means that and that day the Muslims will rejoice. So it's such confidence. It's not just a prediction. It's like, this is a very dangerous prediction. Because if this is wrong, this proves the whole religion of Islam. And what happens? It materializes. Exactly what the Quran says is going to happen, happened.
So would it have been haram to bet on that?
At that time, gambling wasn't actually haram because it became haram to gamble after. The rules of Islam were not all at one time. And one companion of the Prophet, his name was Abu Bakr, his best friend actually. Abu Bakr gambled on the matter. He went and took all his wealth and he went to somebody, he said, you know what? Because he believed this religion so much and he gambled on the matter. And obviously, I don't know, I haven't read the reports of whether he was able to claim his money or not because of how far, you know, it was 8 years later. But the fact is, some would say, what is the evidence outside of the Islamic sources that this actually happened? So I was able to find many sources, but one of them is the Chronicles of Theophanes. And this is something which has been translated now into the English language. The Chronicles of Theophanes is a source which told you exactly when the Roman Empire beat the Persian Empire. And it's written in English. And it's something which is not Islamic, but it's a non-Islamic. It's an extra Islamic source. And you can find it online if one wanted to. Here's the spelling, Chronicles of Theophanes. This source tells you that at that particular time, the Persians had been defeated. And after that, they did exactly as the Quran says. And this is not something which is an Islamic source, a primary source material. It's not even secondary sources. This was a historian, a Roman historian that was writing afterwards. So this is just one of many examples. I mean, there are so many examples of where the Quran and the Sunnah, the Prophet, he told us of something which is going to happen in the future, which then materialized. For example, the Prophet told us, Zuwiya lil ard, that the earth has been made clear for me. فَرَأَيْتُ مَشَارِقَهَا وَمَغَارِبَهَا. So I saw its eastern and western parts. وَإِنَّ أُمَّتِي سَيَبْلُغُ مُلْكُهَا مَا زُوِيَ لِي مِنْهَا. That my people will reach its places, that which has been made clear for me. And if you look at the map of Islam, or the map of the world, you'll find that Saudi Arabia, the east parts and the west parts, are the Muslim countries. That's where Islam spread. But to even add to that, the Prophet told us exactly the countries. He mentioned Egypt. He mentioned Yemen. He mentioned the Levant, Syria, Jordan, Palestine. He mentioned India. And he mentioned present-day Pakistan. So the countries which are Muslim majority, many of those countries, which are Muslim majority countries, they have already been predicted to have, by the Prophet Muhammad, as countries which will be occupied by Islam. And these are just some examples. I mean, there are even examples of what's going to happen today in our times relating to the woke movement. You'll be very surprised about what the Prophet told us of what's going to happen. For instance, on the issue of degeneracy, which you mentioned, the Prophet Muhammad predicted in the hadith, which is authentic, that people will be doing fornication outside of marriage. There will come a time where people will be fornicating outside of marriage to a point where new diseases will be invented. It's not that they will just contract diseases, that there will, new diseases will be invented. There'll be an advent of sexually transmitted diseases. That, in addition to the fact you were talking about crypto, the Prophet Muhammad SAW told us something about the economics of today. He said that it will all be an interest-based system. The whole thing will be an interest-based system. And he mentioned, in lam yakulhu afabathu min ghubar, that even if someone does not consume the interest-based system, he'll be afflicted by its dust. So the entire system, you might have gone to Dubai and Abu Dhabi and you've seen how tall some of the buildings are. Even that's been mentioned by the Prophet. He said, in the future, the barefooted Arab will be competing with one another to create tall buildings. Yatatawaluna fil bunyan. This is mentioned in Bukhari, an authentic source, that they'll be competing with. If you see the Saudi Arabians, they're competing now with the UAE and the Qatar, and they're all trying to create tall buildings. The fact that they have even the money to do that now, I mean, because the thing is, you could say, well, maybe they just, it's a self-fulfilled prophecy. But you can't create a self-fulfilled prophecy if the economic resources are not available. I'm saying that there's a wealth of evidence. There's a wealth of evidence to show that the Prophet Muhammad was a true prophet. Having heard that, are you convinced? To what extent are you satisfied with these evidences? Or do you have anything to ask about those evidence?
Is the interest-based system, yes, does the Quran, is that considered haram?
Yes.
And that's created by who? Who created the interest-based system?
I mean, that's not really a religious question now. That's more of a question we can try and investigate ourselves.
Who do you think?
The Prophet didn't tell us who created it. He just said it's going to be there in the future.
I have another question. This is all very good evidence. And I think you clarified a lot of things that I was curious about knowing. Yeah. Who do you think did 9/11?
I'll be honest, bro. Like, I'll be totally honest with you, right? there was a video. Because obviously, I watched Loose Change. I watched the documentary.
Those are garbage, though. Those are garbage documentaries.
Yes, yes. I've watched all those documentaries and all those kind of things.
Because the Taliban recently came out. The Taliban just said that Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with 9/11. There's no evidence of that.
Yes, of course, of course. But what I was going to say with that is there was one thing which made me doubt the, let's say, the conspiracy narrative, or the so-called conspiracy narrative, which is that it was an inside job. There was one thing that made me doubt it, which is there was a particular speaker, which as a child or as a younger person, I used to listen to him. His name was Anwar al-Awlaki, very well known. And everyone used to listen to him. And then he became like, you know, he was attacked by the government and killed, and he engaged in extremism or whatever, yeah? What I was going to say was he came out on a video on YouTube, okay? And he started speaking about 9/11, and he started speaking about it in a way which seems to praise it, like as if it actually happened and it was praised and all this kind of things. So this, for me, put a spanner in the woodworks, because I can't for sure, I'll be honest with you, tell you that I know what happened on that day. Like, I wouldn't put my money on anything, on anybody or any story or anything. Like, if you say put your kid's life on one story or another, I would say I wouldn't put anyone's life on that. Because, to be honest with you, there's too many ambiguities and vagaries. And so that's my stance. I really don't have a strong opinion on the matter. I've seen some documentaries here and there, but I'm happy to be educated. I'm happy to be, you know, to see documentaries and see evidences and so on. But I can't tell you for sure this is 100% or this is 100% what happened. I think there's problems. I've seen all the things. The evidence is like, you know, the insurance company before and all that. I can't say for sure that means X or that means Y or that means Z. And that's why I don't really make a big deal about this issue, because I like to speak about things which I strongly believe in and that I can evidence without doubt. That one, I would, it's not really my area, if you see what I'm talking about.
Okay. What do you think about the fact that if I, and this is me speaking really candidly, part of the apprehension to embrace Islam is like the amount of people that are going to say that I'm just trying to copy Andrew Tate.
I mean, the thing is, that's a bit of a weird one, because, I mean, at the end of the day, there were greater figures than Andrew Tate in the cultural history of America that have become Muslim. You've mentioned one of them, which is Malcolm X. Are you somewhat African American, or are you fully?
My dad Asian? Is Haitian. My dad is half black. He's from Haiti.
Yeah. So someone who's has African American roots, and you mentioned Malcolm X. See, as you're speaking, I would probably, if I had to guess, I'd probably say you're probably more inspired. You find him more of a figure of inspiration than probably Andrew Tate. And is that correct?
That's correct. And what also do you think about? I'm getting a lot of criticisms from the woke left about the fact that, like, I do engage in premarital sex, and I promote, like, a lot of people think that I want to convert to Islam just for the four wives, and that, like, Islam promotes misogyny, stuff like that. What do you think is the proper response to that?
Look, I mean, it's very difficult to have four wives or even two wives, because when we talk about having wives, it's not the same as having mistresses. These people are part of your life. You've been in relationships before. You see this emotional baggage. You know, you have to provide for these people. You have to put up with, you have to put up with them and so on. And their parents and their, you know, the extended families. You have to put up with, imagine two of that. So if you had one relationship, imagine doubling this. This is a burden, actually, on the man. I consider polygamy as a kind of extraction of resources that benefits women. In fact, there was many studies that were done in Africa. I think the biggest one is done in Tanzania, which showed no harm that was done. In fact, that was the name of the study, that there was no harm that was done through the polygynous action. And by the way, polygyny, or the idea of a man marrying multiple wives, if you go to many places, most places in sub-Saharan Africa, it's freely practiced. I went to Nigeria just 8 months ago. My Christian friends in Nigeria had more than one wife. Christian friends. And in Ghana, they have more than one wife. The tribesman has two, three wives, and, you know, this and that. It's just a normal part of African man's life. I mean, so I think it's sometimes a bit ironic that, you know, these leftists and wokists and whatever, they would never point the finger at the African man and say, look at the barbaric practice of the African. as much as they would with Islam, because they know that there's a racial element there. They don't want to be called racist. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Maybe they'll take the risk, maybe they won't. I don't know. I don't care. But the point is that certainly this is not an action which is specific to Islam or the Muslim people. In fact, Orthodox Judaism allows it. Sikhism allows it. I mean, you could become a Sikh. Why don't you become a Sikh? Because the gurus had more than one wife. The Old Testament that you read, the Christian Old Testament, Solomon had 300 wives. I mean, the Old Testament. Abraham had 2 to 3 wives. I mean, if you count Hajar as a slave girl, then he had 3 sexual partners, which were lawfully and divinely sanctioned. So that's polygyny. That's in the Old Testament. In fact, according to Britannica University, Britannica Encyclopedia, 85 to 95% of the world's population before the modern age committed polygyny. But it's not anti-normative that one man has many women. This is only recently that they've made this like that. This is a recent phenomena. And we can trace it, just like with the whole thing of childhood. We can trace why this happened and how this happened. We go back to the 1960s and we see the second wave feministic movement. And then when women have become forced, I would say, or pressured into the workforce and away from the houses and so on, looking after the children, at the expense, I would say, of the children, that economies and governments no longer had an incentive to keep women at home. And that's half of the job done already, because if women are not going to be at home, they should be at work, because the government wants them to pay them their taxes so the man can have the money at the top. So of course they don't want us to have 4 wives, because they want our wives to work for them. Of course the elitists, they want the woman that will be working for us and for their families and for themselves and for us as well, serving us and serving our kids and serving themselves and serving the family and serving God. Instead of serving all of that, they'd be outside, you know, serving the man in a corporate job, which the man will give her the middle finger, and she will get, according to statistics, in fact, she will get depressed as a result of this. It will cause her psychological pain and anxiety, and the man will be up, the children will be at a worse position as well. So I think this is, bro, people are just waking up. This is not a new thing. It's why do people expect that Sneeko or anybody else has to conform to these ideas? And that if he chooses an idea like Islam, or he's copying that one, or he's doing this, or he's doing, why can't it just be that it makes sense to him? It just makes sense to him. It makes sense to so many people. I myself, I don't know how many, maybe tens of thousands, and this is not an over-exaggeration, the people that either have become Muslim with me, I've seen them, I've told them what I've just told you, and they become Muslim, just like you've seen in Hyde Park, or on the internet, or they declare it somewhere, or through it. So it's not something which is abnormal. So if they say, well, he's trying to copy this one, or it's ridiculous, really. What, I mean, why would you need to copy?
And it's also, that's a stupid reason to not follow what you really believe in. That's exactly. Not, yeah, you're, it's living for the people. I'm just...
You have big figures, like you had, like in the cultural history of America, you had Muhammad Ali, you had Malcolm X, you just mentioned Khabib Nurmagomedov. In many ways, these are all these figures, without exception, are higher rank in terms of social clout than Andrew Tate.
What was your experience? I saw you, I didn't watch the podcast, but what did you think after his conversion?
I thought it was authentic, bro. Like, you know, I sat with him, I spoke with him. I think he's a man that, you know, if you believe in one God and you believe in what we call the fitra, it's a natural sense of morality, which is like, you know, you have to protect your woman and, you know, you have children and, you know, this is called the fitra, the natural predisposition. It's pretty easy to become a Muslim. It is pretty easy, especially as you've mentioned, in the world where we're seeing all this kind of nonsense happening. It's kind of, for me, it's sickening. And I think what you started off with is actually correct in terms of a characterization. When you said that this is a religion of the West, this is absolutely correct. Because first of all, someone will object and say, well, it's not a religion because, you know, a Cambridge definition or Cambridge Dictionary definition or Merriam-Webster definition of the world religion includes things like rituals and divination and so on. The truth is, sociologically, the word religion can mean a system of ideas which tries to explain the world that we live in. For example, Charles Taylor, a great sociologist, had the same idea that you said in the beginning, which is that a religion is not just divining in rituals. It's like it's ideas that shape the world. And nowadays,
they do have rituals, their protests, climate change protests, and the degenerate things they do. I would say that there's a ritualistic aspect of this, of what they practice.
That is a very powerful point. And look, think of it this way: me and you now, when you were in school, we could have, you know, there's religious education and so on. So maybe they'll teach you about maybe the ancient Greeks. They say, look, they used to believe in a goddess called Athena, right? Or the Zeus, you know, you've heard of Zeus, Hercules, and so on. So look, that's what they used to believe in. Okay? And so we'll all look at each other in the classroom and say, why did such a clever people believe in such silly things? That's what we're all thinking. But that is, I would say, it's a more plausible idea than the ideas that they have now. And I'll explain why. At least when the ancient peoples were believing in Zeus, the man with the beard in the sky, basically, which both me and you don't agree with, and we cannot imagine that could be a god. But even then, when they looked at Zeus and said, that's God, that is the god of thunder or the god of whatever, the top god or whatever, even then, it is not as bad as saying X is Y. And that's what they're doing. They're looking at a woman and saying, that woman is not a woman. That woman is whatever she wants to be. So she can decide to be a man. She can decide to be a penguin. She can decide to be whatever I decide to be. And then it becomes ridiculous to a point of comicality, laughable comicality. I was looking at a case recently, an individual, transgender. Well, he wasn't a transgender in the beginning. He was a man, and then he raped somebody in England. And this is the BBC just had the thing. I'm not sure if you saw it. And then, you know, he decided to change, and then they put him into a female's, you know, prison and so on. And then they took
him out. Pretty smart idea.
Yeah, it's a smart idea. I mean, even a Muslim guy, you know, he was taken away from his kid, you know, because as you know, in the West, this is one thing I totally agree with the red pill on. In the West, the idea of like a man having rights to his children and so on, if a woman just accuses him, she can accuse him of domestic violence, abuse or whatever, the Me Too, whatever it may be, and this guy can never see his kid for the rest of his life. It could happen. It's definitely, I know people that it's happened to in the United Kingdom, and it does happen in the United States. So this guy, Muslim guy, his wife, scorn, very bitter woman, immoral woman, went and tried to stop him from seeing his kids using the legal system, okay? Now, what he did is that he went and he said, I'm a woman now. He pretended to transition. And as a result, now he's the mother. So now it's flipping everything on his head. It's a ridiculous notion. And what I'm saying is that when you refer to it in the religion as a religion in the beginning of this podcast, I think it was fitting because anthropologists 100 years from now may very well look at our times, just like we're looking at the ancient Greek people, and say that whereas the ancient Greeks, they believed in gods they couldn't prove, they couldn't see, our people, they were looking at things they could see and they were saying they were not the things they could see. Mm-hmm. It's even more severe than believing about something without evidence because you're rejecting the evidence. What's more severe than believing in something without evidence is to reject the evidence in favor of that which you believe. And that's what they're doing. This is what we're seeing now. The Western religion is a religion. The woke religion of the West is a religion. It's not about creating your own. It's about rejecting your own set of evidences and creating your own fiction that can replace the evidences. And so it is a religion. And so why would anyone want to follow that religion? So if Sneeko or somebody else or Andrew Tate or whoever else decides, you know what, I'm not interested in these kinds of religions. I want to follow a God that created the universe. I don't want to imagine God. The things that you are saying from yourself, I don't want to imagine a God. I want to this and that. I don't want to go into a confession box. So where do you go? What other religions are out there? So I personally believe that we shouldn't care about what people think because, I mean, there's a verse in the Quran that says that وَلَا يَخَافُونَ لَوْمَةَ لَئِمْ. The true believers are the ones who do not fear the blame of the blamers. And there is some strength that one gets from that. Someone becomes Muslim. Certainly, the Muslim community can and should never say this thing. Like, if you become a Muslim, the Muslim community should never say something, oh, he only did it because this person did it. Because how, maybe this person, he made him think about what is this religion, and then he became a Muslim. Many people become Muslim because their spouses become Muslims or because their friends become Muslims. There's no problem. So certainly this is something which should be off limits for any Muslim to say. And if any other non-Muslims say it, then they will be just saying that because they're a bit angry and upset that I think that we are stealing the algorithm. The neo-colonial liberal ideas are now a second-rate set of ideas which are probably going to be thrown with great vehemency into the trash heap of history. So they're upset that with all the money they put into Hollywood and Netflix, that people like Sneeko, who is a man who lives by himself, or I don't know who he lives at, you know, wherever you live.
By myself in Miami. Like,
in Miami, right? And he's you know, just talking and people are listening, and it's you're growing to a point where the government had to step in. I mean, in many ways, that should make you feel a great sense of pleasure and a great sense of achievement. Because if they needed to step in, you're one of the only examples in my mind that I can think of that has required a decision from the top to be made about you. From wherever they are, these guys, they came together and they said, this guy, he's saying too many things. We need to get rid of him.
It's remarkable. When that happened, I thought that would have been... There's so many moments where I'm like, okay, the woke left needs to realize that they're wrong now. But even when that happened, they're like, it's no big deal. They play a lot of clips in the Senate. It was just a little moment. It was only 15 seconds of a stream. It doesn't mean that they're actually... So they will adamantly defend wokeism so hard. So... It's I don't really take that type of pride and pleasure because it's just like even Project Veritas came out with this video exposing Pfizer, and still everyone is so quick to defend the people that don't care about them and the people that want them controlled. So my work is not done. There's a lot more to do.
Well, I think it's been a pleasure speaking to you. I mean, I'm aware that I don't know what time it is where you are. It's pretty late here. I've explained to you the brief outline of Islam. We've spoken somewhat about your situation. Is there anything else that you want to ask or speak about before we close the podcast?
Do you think it's worth moving to Dubai?
Bro, I'll be honest with you. Dubai is a great country and all. And I wouldn't... Dubai is not a country. The UAE is the country. Yeah. Dubai is one of the biggest cities, isn't it? Me personally, if you like traditional values, let's say, and you want to have a family setting, then there are better options in Dubai. Like I would say Doha is a better option, which is the capital of Qatar. And it has all this, the kind of technological advancements that Dubai has. Maybe not at that level, but still, it's if you want a family environment, it's Doha. And this might be a bit of a difficult in terms of the family unit, in terms of the language barrier, sorry, but Istanbul. I think it's a great country, or Turkey. It's one of the biggest cities in the world. It's infrastructurally developed. They've got great culture because Dubai is deplete of a bit of culture. Now it's like 90% people, they speak English now in that country. They no longer speak Arabic. So if you want, it depends on what you like. If your taste is for something like, if you want culture, if you want history, then somewhere like Istanbul, where you can still make a living, you can still do your videos, you can still... eat good, you can still, you know, they've got good wrestlers out there if you like to wrestle, if you like to do this kind of thing. They've got stuff. If what you want is more, you know, just, you know, to go gyms and to go out, you know, obviously I wouldn't endorse that kind of a lifestyle, but that's what people go to Dubai for. But then you've got Las Vegas, quite frankly. I don't know why you got New York. I think New York is more impressive than Dubai, for example. Like, as a person, I've been to New York and I've been to Dubai. I think that being in Manhattan is more impressive than being in somewhere like Dubai. So yes, that's what I would say to you, bro. Like in terms of a family, because I think someone like you now, you're probably at the stage in your life where you're thinking, you know what? Why not start a family? Because that might be the thing to do, bro. You just start a family, hopefully a Muslim one when you become Muslim, when we speak a bit in more detail than private.
Yeah.
You know, a Muslim family with a few wives. And that's fine, because I think that's what you'll probably need. But coming back from the background that you've come, you might need two or three wives. You know, a lot of brothers that have, you know, had the lifestyle like you have, it's very difficult for them to be with one woman. And so long as you tell, like, you know, I mean, to be honest with you, if you set expectations with your wives, you know, in the beginning that I'm going to marry another woman or whatever, it's a very plausible thing. You know, many of my, I'm not going to say most of my friends, but many of them have 2-3 wives and they're living fine lives, and all the women are obedient and submissive, and they bear the children of the man, and in the Islamic culture there's no such thing as a man, you know, it's shunned upon a woman going out and, you know, speaking and fraternizing and messing around with another man. We have this concept called ghira, which is the protective jealousy. This is one of the great differences between Islam and red pill, that the concept of ghira is that my woman is, no one's looking at her, no one's touching her, no one's doing nothing with her, you know. So I, you know, that is the idea that I'm not in control, but I am in charge of this woman. You know, no one comes close to this woman, no one touches her, no one looks at her, and it can can reach very high proportions. One person, one of the companions of the Prophet, Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, he said that if I ever saw my wife of another man, and we're not endorsing anything illegal, but I'm just mentioning, if I ever saw my wife with another man, he would see the tip of my sword, basically. And then the Prophet Muhammad said that, أَتَعْجَبُونَ مِنْ غِيرَةِ سَعْدٍ, are you estranged by the protective jealousy of this man? Because he said that I, as the Prophet, I am even more protectively jealous over my, yani, I'm more protectively jealous than he is. So this idea of protecting a woman, keeping her safe, not doing nothing, this is a big thing in Islam. And I think that this is one of the ways that a man shows affection, natural and beautiful kinds of affection, to a woman. But so this will be something that you would, that you should expect. And inshallah, I'll speak to you privately. I'll give you some resources and some videos. I'll send you my number so that we can speak on WhatsApp or something like that. And hopefully, bro, I think that maybe Islam is the option for you, because it will change your life 100%. I mean, it gives psychological strength and resilience, the like of which nothing else can. Does that sound okay, my friend?
It does. It does. And there's a lot of... not only am I still searching for the right religion, but it does conflict with the stuff I do right now. See, if I'm being completely honest, I see the benefit in still being the person who's searching, because then you get people from different religions that come in and they like to see your journey. And so if you commit to one, then you alienate the others, you know. And being in this place now, you're able to go speak to different people and have more open conversation, which that doesn't conflict with my beliefs right now. But if I'm being honest, I see the benefit in this place right now. But I do want to find an actual theology that I can, with some core tenets.
Fantastic. I'll send you some stuff. And it's been a pleasure speaking to you, Sneeko. If you need anything from me, I'll give you my number that you can reach out. And for those watching at home, that was Sneeko, a person, unfortunately, who has fallen prey to some of the coercive methods of the elitists at the top, who have removed him from a platform. I will have to say that it's something really highly questionable, something which I can't endorse or respect. And it's something which we, the Muslim community, are watching closely. Because I have to say that if this happens to any one of us, then this will have tremendous implications for freedom of speech in the West. Because now these platforms have become one of the only ways that religious communities, minorities, and others can basically put their opinion forward, which reduces their levels of frustration that could otherwise result in extremism and radicalism, the like of which we don't want to experiment with. And so I say, I think there must be consistency, and there must be self-accountability on issues relating to this. I thank Sneeko one more time for joining me in this podcast. It is an hour and a half now. And with that, I conclude. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.